أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وبه نستعين، إنه خير ناصر ومعين. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله، السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. في سير صلوات على محمد. My respected elders, brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah for the opportunity to be able to gather together with our fellow mu'mineen and fellow mourners and rememberers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam. The purpose of our gathering is to please Allah by reminding ourselves of our responsibility towards the Imam of our time through the tears that we shed for Imam Hussein and his family and his companions. The topic that I've been discussing has been living in a culture of instant gratification. And over the course of the previous nights, we talked about different aspects of this culture. And I've been trying to show how, even though this may be the predominant culture, one of wanting things and being able to attain them without any delay, instantly, being gratified at a very shallow level, looking at things in a very material and shallow level. Despite that being the case, there is an alternative, which is the Tawhidi culture. And throughout, we're trying to show how, and compare and contrast how things and issues come up and are dealt with in the culture of instant gratification, and how we can look at those same things from the Islamic perspective and understand how to do them correctly. Last night, the discussion had to do with raising children. Now tonight, I would like to switch focus to talk about another area of living. And I'd like to discuss the topic of interacting with other people, befriending other people, interoperating with other cultures, integration. In the culture of instant gratification, somebody who accepts that, the criterion for whom I should interact with is how does that other person make me feel. If it's a case that being with this person or being with this group of people is fun, makes me feel happy, is entertaining, then I go for it. And that's my primary consideration, that this person is somebody who gives me a good time. Or from another perspective, you could say that in this type of thinking, this type of shallow thinking, that path of least resistance is the one that I'm going to take when it comes to interacting with other people. So, where it might be the case that there's somebody that I should be avoiding or that I should be minimizing my interaction with them, if that's going to be something difficult for me, then I'm going to just basically forget about minimizing the interaction, just go ahead and interact with them in a normal sort of way. And inshallah, we'll talk about some examples a little bit later. On the other hand, according to the standard of instant gratification, if it's the case that I'm supposed to keep in touch with somebody, I'm supposed to befriend them, I'm supposed to be maintaining ties with them, but that maintenance is difficult, it requires effort, it requires chasing up, then because it's a trouble, because I don't see any immediate benefits in doing it, then I'm not going to go for that either. Now, this is just an introduction, a preface to understand, first of all, typically how it's done out there, and now we need to go back and examine and see what sort of guidelines do we have within the teachings of Islam, within the Quran and the Ahadith, for how we should be interacting with others. Please say salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I'd like to invite you to look at the Surah Mumtahana, which is Surah number 60 of the Quran, verses 8 and 9. In these verses, we've been given very clear principles for how is it that we should interact with other people. And according to these verses, the other is divided into two groups. Now, let's look at what these verses have to say. Number one, verse number 8. Allah says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم لا ينهاكم الله عن الذين لم يقاتلوكم في الدين ولم يخرجوكم من دياركم أن تبروهم وتقسطوا إليهم إن الله يحب المقسطين. Allah does not forbid you in regard to those who did not make war against you on account of your religion and did not expel you from your homes, that you deal with them with kindness and justice. Indeed, Allah loves the just. This verse is laying out a principle of how we ought to operate with those people who do not accept the religion of Islam, but at the same time, they are not at war or in opposition with Islam. Allah tells us that your responsibility with regards to this group of people is number one, that you should deal with them with kindness, and number two, that you should deal with them with justice. On the other hand, إِنَّمَا يَنْهَاكُمُ اللَّهُ عَنِ الَّذِينَ قَاتَلُوكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ. Allah forbids you only in regard to those who fight you and oppose you on account of your faith and religion. And the other things that they do is وَأَخْرَجُوكُمْ مِنْ دِيَارِكُمْ. They try to expel you from your homes. وَظَاهَرُوا عَلَىٰ إِخْرَاجِكُمْ أَن تَوَلَّوْهُمْ وَمَنْ يَتَوَلَّهُمْ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمَ الظَّالِمُونَ. For these people who are the enemies of your faith, the enemies of the religion of God, the enemies of Islam, it's forbidden for you to make friends with them or to support them or to join their camps. And whoever does that is going to be among the ظالمين, the oppressors. So we see here that the non-Muslim, according to these verses, these two verses, is divided into two categories. One group are those who are not Muslim, but they're not in opposition to Islam. And the other one are people who are trying to actively rise up and they are at war with Islam. When it comes to that first group, our responsibility is to treat them kindly and to do just and to be just with them. And for the most part in this society, for the most part, when we go about our different affairs, whether it be our neighbors, whether it be our co-workers, whether it be the people that we study with, etc., those people who are not Muslim, for the most part, they fall into this category of people who are not Muslim, yet they're not opposed to Islam. And in this regard, we are told that we are supposed to treat them justly, and being just to them means a whole lot of different things. It means acting friendly, it means interacting, it means being able to conduct transactions, it means being able to greet them, to gift them, and to be friendly with them, to invite them to the truth and discuss with them, etc. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's a famous saying that we have from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Talib alayhi salam. It comes to us from the treatise that he had written up as an instruction for his governor Malik al-Ashtar, who was going to Egypt. Now, just as a side note, this guidance that he gave him, which is also compiled in Nahj al-Balagha, has been the focus of attention recently by even organizations like the UN, because they're amazed at how an individual writing at that time could give so much relevant advice to how a country should be run, even for people who are living at this time as well too. And they've just started picking some of the stones from the pebbles of that shore of the ocean that lies within Imam Ali alayhi salam. What they understand is just that much. Now, what does he say in course of this letter? He's instructing Malik al-Ashtar as to how he should be a governor. He tells him, develop in your heart the feeling of love for your people. Malik was governing people. Among them, there were groups of non-Muslims who are known as Ahlul Dhimma. You see, within the Islamic State, there is allowance for people to live within it, yet not accept Islam. There are certain constrictions and certain taxes that they have to pay. But at the same time, they enjoy the security apparatus of the Muslim nation, and their rights are respected and they are treated with justice as well too. And Malik, going to Egypt, had such groups of people who were under his rule. Imam tells him, develop in your heart the feeling of love for your people, and let it be a source of acting kind to them. Do not behave with them like a tyrant, and do not appropriate yourself to that which belongs to them. If only people who are ruling our governments today were to take advice like this and see what Imam Ali Islam is saying. Remember that the citizens of the state are of two categories. فَإِنَّهُمْ صِنْفَانِ إِمَّا أَخٌ لَكَ فِي الدِّينِ وَإِمَّا نَذِيرٌ لَكَ فِي الْخَلْقِ. They are either your brethren in religion or your peer in creation. They are subject to infirmities and liable to commit mistakes. Sometimes they make mistakes, but forgive them even as you would like God to forgive you. And we see that this type of treatment of people who are not at war with Islam is part of the seerah of Imam Ali al-Islam as well too. One time we're told that he had a governor who was appointed to a land, I believe it was Persia. His name was Umar ibn Salama. Now Umar was somebody who didn't follow the instructions of the Imam. He was being unjust to the Ahlul Kitab who were living in that country. Those people who are non-Muslim wrote a letter to Imam Ali, who was the Khalifa of that time, complaining about the treatment that the Khalifa, that the representative of the Khalifa was giving to them. They complained to Imam Ali Islam. Imam Ali, when he gets the letter, look at what he says. He writes a letter then back to his governor. He said that I've thought about what they're telling me. He informed him that there's been a complaint received. I've thought about this complaint. He says that because they are mushrik, because they are not Muslim, I don't see it fitting for them to be close to me. I'm not going to go and take their side completely. But at the same time, it's not befitting for me to ignore their plea as well. Because after all, they are under a contract with us. They are living as Ahlul Dhimma with us. And therefore, they are within the protection of the Islamic government. Therefore, I wish that you treat them in a nice sort of manner, and overlook their faults, and do not be fierce and harsh with them, and act justly towards them. Please say salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So brothers and sisters, this gives us one division of the other, how we should be interacting with them and interoperating with them. However, this is not the only type of division that we've been given, and the only type of categories that we've been asked to divide and how we should interact with the others, with non-Muslims. Let me take you back to that saying of Imam Ali al-Islam, where he says that everyone, he's telling Malik, that everyone is either your brother in the religion or your peer in creation. Many of you have heard that saying before. But oftentimes it is mistranslated. Oftentimes people say the following, that Imam told us that everyone is either your brother in religion or your brother in creation. Imam Ali Islam doesn't say that. He doesn't say that somebody is either a brother in religion or a brother in creation. He says that either he's a brother in religion or your peer in creation. This is an important point, because brotherhood is something different than treating somebody with justice. Let me explain a little bit more. Let's go back to the Quran. The Quran gave us those general principles. But it also tells us other things as well too. And we have to, when we're trying to understand how we should interact with the other, we have to look at the sum total of all the instructions that we have. Surah An-Najm, Surah 53, verse number 29. A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. فَأَعْرِضْ أَمَّنْ تَوَلَّى عَنْ ذِكْرِنَا وَلَمْ يُرِدْ إِلَّا الْحَيَاةَ الدُّنْيَا ذَلِكَ مَبْلَغُهُمْ مِنَ الْعِلْمِ. As for those who turn away from our remembrance, you turn away from them and you avoid them. These are the ones who desire nothing but the life of this world. This verse is telling us something else. It's saying that, now that was one division that we had, we talked about previously, but here there's another division being described, other verses as well too. Well, we're being told that when it comes to having close and intimate relationships, when it comes to having close friends, when it comes to having people with whom we share our life experiences, here there's another circle being drawn. There's another guideline being offered here, which is that when there is somebody who is full of ghafla, somebody who turns away from the remembrance of Allah, that person is not befitting for you to keep close company with. Now this point may be something that is difficult to swallow for some of the believers. Because after all, you might be saying that, how can that be the case? We're living in the society, there's other people who are there. How can I possibly think about not keeping some people in my close circles? But we have to understand that this is the teachings of the deen. Let me give you some more examples. There was somebody who was a very illustrious companion of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. He was known as Al-Ja'fari. Al-Ja'fari goes to the Imam. The Imam here is Imam Abu al-Hasan. It's either our 8th Imam or our 10th Imam, alayhim as-salam. When the Imam sees him, he says, why is it that I see that you are keeping company with Abdul Rahman ibn Ya'qub? Now, Abdul Rahman ibn Ya'qub was somebody who was living in the Muslim society. He was a Muslim. However, he had an ideology which was different than the ideology of the Imams alayhi salam. He believed something regarding the attributes of God which was opposed to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So, how is it that Ja'fari responds to this question of the Imam? He says that he's my uncle, I'm spending time, the reason why you see me keeping frequent company with him is because he's my uncle, he's my family member. The Imam Islam tells him that he says things about Allah which are very great and very strange. He describes Allah and attributes things to Him in a way which are inappropriate, while Allah is not describable in such a way. Then he tells him the following. He says that either you come and you spend time in our company. Sorry, he says that either you come, you go and spend time in his company, and you leave aside spending time in our company, or you come and spend time in our company and you leave him aside. Now, I just want to clarify something here, that when it comes to the obligation of not cutting off family ties, that's something which is still in place right here, because it seems that he's his relative, he's his uncle. Imam Ali isn't telling him go and cut ties with him. He's talking about keeping frequent company and being seen frequently and learning from him and spending time with him and being a close confidant of this individual who had beliefs that were misguided. Now, the companion, he says that, well, let him say what he's saying. I believe in what I'm saying. How is that a problem? And the Imam alayhi salam says that, aren't you scared that the same punishment that befalls him is going to befall you? And then he goes and gives a story. This tradition, by the way, appears in Al-Kafi, and it's reported in other books and other sources as well too. He gives him a story. He says that there was a Shia of Nabi Musa alayhi salam, a follower of Nabi Musa. And he was somebody whose father was a supporter of the Pharaoh. Now this son, who was a supporter of Nabi Musa alayhi salam, was always trying to convince his father of the truth. He was arguing with him, he was spending time with him. But he was doing so even to the point where it was extreme. He was going beyond what was called upon for him. Even up to the point that they were had reached the river's banks and Nabi Musa had parted it, he was still lagging behind. He hadn't gone with Nabi Musa alayhi salam. And the Imam alayhi salam goes on to describe, he says that he was with his father, he was discussing, debating with him until the water started crashing down. And just as his father was drowned as well, his son was drowned as well too. Now this is very interesting because there's a question that should be coming to our mind, which is that what crime did he commit? He was trying to just bring his father into the right side. Now the Imam al-Islam clarifies, he knows that we have that question as well too. He says that please say salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He says that they brought Nabi Musa alayhi salam news of what happened. They told him what took place. Nabi Musa says the following. He says that that individual, that follower of mine, he is in the rahmah of Allah. He has gotten his reward. There's no question about that. It's not that because he was there somehow he was punished, but he says that when that bala, when that niqama, when that punishment descends, then anybody who is even in the proximity of the sinner is going to be affected by that punishment as well too. Now, brother and sister, this is a very important tradition. The verses are very important as well too. How do we understand this? What's the problem? What's the problem with me taking a friend, let's say, of somebody who has no religion, and I'm taking him as my close friend, I tell him all my secrets, right? But after all, he doesn't talk to me about the religion. Right? We just talk about other things. What's the problem with that? What's the problem of letting my children freely go to the neighbors' homes and they come back and they come here and we go there? And as long as my children are saying their prayers on time and we're making sure that they don't eat the haram food from the other homes, what's the problem? When we go to the verses, we go to the ahadith, we see a few different reasons. Number one is that when we see somebody who is committing a sin, for example, listening to music which is haram. For example, when it comes to our youth, when it comes to having boyfriends and girlfriends, etc. When somebody sees that, even though they themselves may not be practicing it, just by seeing it, it becomes a source of impression for them. Remember that story that we began this whole series with. Nabi Musa and his people have just crossed the river. And they pass by these people who are worshipping idols. They're so impressed when they actually see the way that they're worshipping idols, these idols, that they tell Nabi Musa, "Oh Nabi Musa, why don't you make us some gods the way that they have gods as well too?" There's a lesson in that for human nature. Right? Why is that? Why is it that Allah gives us that story? There's a lesson for human nature that we're easily impressionable. You know how it is, right? That sometimes you can hear a tune. You're just passing by, and you hear a tune, and you know, being a good Muslim, you're not listening to it, right? You're closing, you're trying to shut off your ears, you're not listening to it, but you hear the tune. And a few hours later, when you're free, suddenly the same tune comes back into the mind. Right? It happens. Okay? Sometimes even years later, this tune that you heard years before, you hear it again, and then it's like, whoa, it's embedded in my memory. That's the nature of the human being, is that we're easily impressionable by the surroundings that we have. That's reason number one. Number two is a philosophical reason, which is that we have a purpose in our lives, brothers and sisters, which is to attain proximity to Allah. Every moment of our lives is precious. Any moment that of our life that we waste, that goes in vain, at one point, we'll go back and reflect upon that and we'll be regretful. We'll say that, oh, if I could go back. لَأَلِّي أَرْجِعُ The Quran mentions this so many times, that if only I could go back and redo what I did. But that won't be the time for going back again. Every moment that we have is precious. If we spend that time with people whose main mission in life is something other than God, then how is that time going to be productive for us? It's something which makes very logical sense. I want to read to you or translate for you something that Ayatollah Behjad rahmatullahi alayh has said regarding this point. And this particular piece of advice that he's given, I feel, is very comprehensive and summarizes the entire gist of what it is that I've been trying to give in this lecture. Peace be upon Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Now, who is Ayatollah Behjad? I think everyone pretty much knows, but in case somebody would like to be introduced to Ayatollah Behjad, one way of being introduced to him is to be introduced to him by means of his salat. Go and see how this man used to stand in prayer and how the tears used to fall from his eyes. You can see the videos on YouTube or Shia TV. Better go to Shia TV. Go and see how this was, and you will perhaps learn something about who Ayatollah Behjad was. Although they say, وَمَا أَدْرَاكَ مَا Ayatollah Behjad. How is it that we can understand who he actually was? This is the advice that he gives. He says that it's very clear that if somebody were to read Qur'an every day, if they were to read du'as every day, if they were to go to the masajid, the prayer halls, if they were go to for ziyarah to the holy places, if they were go to visit the ulama and the good and righteous mu'mineen, and if they were to spend time with them, then this would be pleasing to God and the Messenger of God. And on a day-by-day basis, they would, as they're more careful about themselves, they would see that their desire to perform that ibadah will increase. Okay, in that small statement right there, he's giving us a bit of a tip, a practical tip as to how we can grow closer to Allah. That's on one hand. Now, on the other hand, this is the part which is relevant to our discussion. He said the following. He says that, on the other hand, if somebody spends a lot of time with people who are in a state of ghafla, that includes non-Muslims, because they're not on the same path, if they spend a lot of time with them, this will result in hardness of the heart and darkness of the heart. This is a doctor of the heart who's telling us this. And it would result in our losing the desire to perform ibadah of Allah. And he says that not only would that happen, but also he's saying that it would result in the weakness of our iman, and it would result in those good things that we've acquired through salat, through Qur'an, through ziyarah, through visiting mu'mineen, for those good things to go and turn into bad things as well too. Meaning not only is it not productive, but it's going to harm whatever capital we've already acquired until now. Now that's something which is extremely severe. Inshallah, I pray that we can take this advice into stride and act upon it. Peace be upon Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Until now, brothers and sisters, I've explained how within the teachings of Islam, we have two different divisions of how we should be integrating, interacting with the other. One of them had to do with day-to-day sort of operations and interactions. One of them has to do with that group of people that we're going to have intimate and close relationships with. And the line has been laid cleared for us as to whom these people should be. Of course, there's exceptions. There's some cases where it's necessary. We have, for example, somebody in the home who is not practicing. In that case, of course, we have to be interacting with them and being closer to them, and they're part of our circle. Or there's other cases, for example, where there's an opportunity for us to be able to guide somebody, and therefore we're going to bring them into our close circle. We're going to spend extra time with them, talk to them, invite them, because there's a possibility of guiding them, and we're qualified to do that as well too. Then of course that's an exception to it. This isn't a hard and fast principle that applies in all cases, but as a general principle, when it comes to our interoperation with others, these are some guidelines that we have. Now, these are some ideas, some theories, some guidelines. One of the applications of this is how it is that our children interact with others when it comes to the school environment. That's something, inshallah, that I wish to touch on a bit in tomorrow night's lecture, if Allah gives us tawfiq. It's something that I'd like you to think about, inshallah. But I just want to mention one other point tonight, and inshallah we'll move to the masail portion, which is the same culture which tells us that if it's easy to make a friendship with this person and easy to spend time with them, then I'll do so, even if it's not productive for me in the long run. The same culture tells us that if it's difficult for me to maintain a relationship with somebody, then I'm just going to drop it. I'm just going to cut it off. Now this is something which is very dangerous for us, because one of the most important responsibilities that we have, one of the awjabul wajibat, is that of keeping ties with our relatives. Let me just give you a tradition that we have that gives us a clue as to how important this is. The fifth Imam Islam reports from the Prophet of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He says, I wish that everyone who listens to this will tell all those who are not even here the following. That he says that when it comes to that, one of your obligations that you have is that you should be having relationships with your family. Even if it means that you have to take the effort of traveling for 1 year to be able to maintain that relationship. Now sometimes, in this culture, we find it difficult to make one phone call. We find it difficult to travel 15 minutes, half an hour. Once every year to fly a couple of hours. We find it to be something which is so difficult. To send one email, to send one message. We find it just something not in sync with the type of vast lifestyle that we have. But this is the advice that we have from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Where sometimes it becomes so easy for us to even cut off from mu'mineen because of the slightest thing that happens. We just stop talking to them. Right? Whereas one of the things that's most detested by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam is when two mu'mineen, two believers, two people who call themselves followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, that they should stop talking to each other. In tradition, we're told that the Imam alayhi salam will come and curse both of them. Even if one of them is not at fault. And then when the companion asks that how could he curse both of them, the Imam alayhi salam says that because why isn't it the one who is wronged, why doesn't he go and himself go to the one who has wronged him and say that look it, you know, let's patch up, let's mend, because this is not the way it's supposed to be. These are teachings which lie contrary to some of the spirit that lies within the culture of instant gratification. I pray that we can inshallah learn these and understand them and apply them to our lives. Peace be upon Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. It is the month of Muharram. As we draw closer to that day of Ashura, our minds and our hearts become increasingly preoccupied with the tragedy that took place on that day. And as we come to the majalis, as we listen to the poetry, as we beat our chests, as we remember and reflect, the scenes become more vivid for us. One of the most vivid scenes that we have from Karbala is that of these men, thousands of armed men, standing in front of a small army in which there are small children as well. We're told that among those who gave their life for Imam Hussein alayhi salam were 10 to 11 children who were underage. 10 to 11 children are facing an army of thousands of armed men. One of these children is talked about in the histories that have been written about Karbala. He is so small, seemingly not from any significant tribe, that we don't even know what his name is. But his act of sacrifice has been captured in history for eternity. There was a boy who was standing there watching the companions one by one give up their lives. One of those companions was his own father. He sees his father being brutally massacred by these thousands of soldiers. But instead of being scared by this, instead of running away as any normal child would do, he goes to his mother who happens to be there as well. And he says to her that, I wish to go out and fight. She tells him that, Ukhruj ya bunay. Go.
Go fight. This is what you can do. وَقَاتِلْ بَيْنَ يَدَيِّ إِبْنِ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ Go and fight for the son of the Messenger of Allah. As we talk about this boy's story and a couple of the other boys who gave up their lives in Karbala, we have to ask ourselves that what sort of upbringing did these children have? That in this most difficult of tests, they want nothing and they long nothing but to serve the cause of Allah and the cause of their Imam alayhi salam. This young boy is going to the battlefield. Imam Hussein alayhi salam is crying out. He's saying that this is just a young boy. They killed his father. Perhaps his mother will not like for him to now be killed as well. Let her at least have some family member with her to take care of her. But the boy tells him that no, indeed it is my mother who has ordered me to go into the battlefield. He goes forth and he cries out, Amiri Husaynu wa ni'amal amiru sururu fu'adil bashir al-nadhiri Ali wa Fatimatu walidahu fahal ta'alamuna lahu min nadhiri. My master is Hussein, and what a beautiful master he is. He was the one who was the pleasure of the heart of the Prophet who came as a warner and a bearing of good tidings. Ali and Fatima were his parents. Do you know anybody who is better than him? But what can a boy do? What can a small boy do against this army? Eventually, they cut off his head. And in all their brutality, they throw his head back to the camp. But his mother, instead of being upset by it, takes up the head of her blessed child and she charges against the enemy army. Until Imam Hussein alayhi salam has to order that they restrain her and let her not give up her own life in that way. This is one example that we have of somebody who is not even related to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. But what about his own nephews? Among those of whose nephews who were there were two boys known as Aun and Muhammad. Aun and Muhammad were the sons of Abdullah ibn Ja'far al-Tayyar. Zainab salamullahi alayha was there with them in Karbala. Abdullah himself could not attend. He could not participate, but later on, he would always take pride saying that I was not able to be there, but I send my sons as my representative. And he was very proud as a father of what his sons were able to accomplish. Zainab salamullahi alayha, on the day of Ashura, is there. She knows that her brother is there. She knows that her brother needs help. She has little that she can offer from herself. She cannot go to the battlefield. But she has her son. She has Aun and Muhammad. This is a gift that she can offer to her brother Hussein alayhi salam. صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله صلى الله عليك يا ابن رسول الله أيها الشهيد بكربلاء Peace and blessings upon you, O chief of the martyrs, the one who was martyred in Karbala. Peace be upon you and on those two young martyrs, Aun and Muhammad. There comes a point when it is time for the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam to show their loyalty to Imam Hussein. One by one they go. Among them is Ali Akbar and Qasim. Aun and Muhammad must have been watching them. They too would not like to be left out from this great sacrifice. They take permission from their uncle. He gives them permission. Muhammad goes first. He fights bravely. He tries to present his case, but they do not listen to him. And then it is time for his brother Aun.
Aun alayhi salam goes to the battlefield. He introduces himself saying the following, In tunkiruni fa ana ibn Ja'fari. If you don't know who I am, then I am the grandson of Ja'far. Shahidu sidqin fil jinani azharu. He is the one who is the martyr who is now in the gardens of paradise, very radiant. يَطِيرُ فِيهَا بِجَنَاحٍ أَخْضَرًا He is flying around with wings which are green because Ja'far was a martyr whose hands were chopped off in that battle. كَفَى بِهَذَا شَرَفًا فِي الْمَحْشَرِ This enough is a source of honor for him in the hereafter. But after all, what can a boy do? What can a boy do against the army? Both of them are martyred. But what we see, brothers and sisters, is that in history, nowhere is it reported that Zainab alayha salam reacts in any special way when her son is killed. Perhaps instead of being upset, she is smiling, knowing that all of her efforts in bringing up these children have finally borne fruit. But when it comes to the children of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the love that Zainab has for them is something different. When Ali Akbar alayhi salam, his body is being trampled by the enemy, Zainab can contain herself no longer. She comes out from the tent and cries out, Ya Habiba, Ya Buna Akha, O my beloved nephew, O my Ali Akbar. Hussein alayhi salam has to come and take her away from the body of her nephew. Alaa la'natullahi 'ala al-qawm al-zalimin wa say'alamu alladhina zalamu ayyamun qalibin yanqalibun. Matam Hussein. Ya Hussein.